From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. While reporting on the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, our guest Stephen Brill received some shocking personal health news.
I was told that I had this bubble on my heart, which had a 15 to 17% chance each year of bursting, and if it did, I'd be dead before I got to the operating room.
Today, Brill tells us about the political fights, lobbying, and compromises that led to Obamacare and gives us his perspective on the law as a reporter and patient.
Now I'm going to say something that's going to get you and your listeners angry.
Okay, maybe. Try me.
The insurance companies are not really the bad actors in this movie.
Brill's new book, America's Bitter Pill, expands on his Time magazine cover story about why medical bills are expensive and incomprehensible. We'll examine his own hospital bills. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks at the career of rhythm and blues singer Barbara Lynn. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What are the odds? While reporting on the rollout of Obamacare, Stephen Brill got an education in being a patient. He was diagnosed with a life-threatening condition that required heart surgery. This was not long after he'd written a special report for Time magazine investigating the inflated charges in hospital bills. After winning a National Magazine Award for that report, he ended up with pages and pages of his own inflated and confusing hospital charges. Now he's written a book about the political fights and the medical and pharmaceutical industry lobbying that made it difficult to pass any health care reform and led to the compromises of the Affordable Care Act, which enables millions more people to afford health insurance, but also adds new layers of bureaucracy and many confusing new regulations. Brill is a journalist who also founded Court TV, American Lawyer Magazine, 10 regional legal newspapers, and Brill's Content Magazine. He teaches journalism at Yale. Stephen Brill, welcome to Fresh Air. After writing your Time magazine story about the costs of healthcare and why individual items cost so much, you got very sick. You were diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm that required heart surgery. So this was as you were in the middle of researching your current book, America's Bitter Pill. What are some of the things that you learned about the difference between being a patient and being a journalist when it comes to healthcare?
Well, the first thing I learned was something that that you and I probably can appreciate on an intellectual basis, but not on an emotional basis, which is that a patient in the American healthcare system has very little leverage, has very little knowledge, has very little power. Now, I knew that. I'd written it. And as I was completing the reporting of the book, literally on the last day for enrollment into the Affordable Care Act on the exchanges on March 31st, I was told that I had this heart problem. And actually, I didn't get very sick at all. I was feeling completely fine, but I was just told that I had this bubble on my heart, which would show no symptoms at all, but it just had a 15 to 17% chance each year of bursting, and if it did, I'd be dead before I got to the operating room. So there I was, a reporter who had made hospital presidents and hospital executives and healthcare executives and insurance company executives, sweat because I asked them all kinds of questions about their salaries and their profit margins. And now I was, lying on a gurney in a hospital in real fear of my life. And at that moment, I wasn't worried about costs. I wasn't worried about, a cost-benefit analysis of this drug or this medical device. I wasn't worried about healthcare policy. And it drove home to me the reality that in addition to being a tough political issue because of all the money involved, healthcare is a toxic political issue because of all the fear and the emotion involved.
Are there things you previously, as a journalist, might have thought of as being unnecessary in terms of healthcare and too expensive that now seemed really worth it to you?
Well, it's not a question of whether, if you're stepping back and saying, well, is it worth it, that you sort of make a different kind of an analysis. It's just that when you're a patient, when you're in pain, when you're in fear, you don't make that analysis at all, and you don't want anyone to make that analysis. This is a matter of pain versus no pain, life versus death. And if a doctor says you need two blood tests a day just to be sure, you say, fine. If I need five, I'll do five. If I need 10, I'll do 10. If I need two x-rays of my chest after I have open heart surgery, that's okay with me. Whatever you say, I will do because I am terrified.
So for your Time magazine story, you'd studied seven people's bills and did a line-by-line analysis of how the charges were computed and why they were so high. What was your bill? What was your total bill?
The total bill for the surgeon, the hospitalization, the tests and everything was approximately $190,000.
How much of that did you have to pay?
Which I paid, I think I paid probably $12,000 of it. I exhausted the deductible on the policy that my wife and I had. And once I paid the $12,000, I was indifferent to all the costs because I was paying a zero. Once I achieved, you know, my maximum out-of-pocket, as they say, you know, nothing mattered to me.
Okay, so you write that you got 36 different first-class envelopes from United Healthcare, which was your insurer, and each had an explanation of benefits, one of those papers that says this is not a bill, but it tells you everything that you were expensed for.
Right.
So each had an explanation of benefits for a separate treatment related to your surgery, or one for a prescription drug, or for each lab test done outside the hospital, one for each doctor, one covering your main hospital bill. So when you got these explanations of benefits, did you immediately know how to read them? Because you'd done a whole story about this. Like, you were a pro in how
to
analyze these
bills. I think of myself as a fairly well-educated person. I have a law degree from Yale, and as you point out, I'd been writing about this stuff and reading this stuff for a long time, and I couldn't understand most of those. You know, but for starters, it's hard to understand why you get 36 different first-class envelopes with 36 different pieces of paper from the same insurance company on the same day. That tells you something about the efficiency of the healthcare industry right there. But then as you open each envelope, they're as completely unintelligible to me as they are to you and as they are to everyone listening. But better yet, they're also unintelligible, apparently, to the people who write them. I got to do what is, you know, probably a reporter's dream, and probably something that a lot of our listeners would love to do, which is I took one of those explanation of benefits, which said amount billed, zero. Amount insurance company paid, zero. And then the third column said amount you owe, $154.
That makes no sense.
Okay, so it makes no sense. But here's what I got to do. I had scheduled, as part of the reporting for my book, an interview with the CEO of United Healthcare, the largest health insurance company in the United States, and my health insurance company, as it turns out. So I went out to Minnesota to interview him and asked him all kinds of questions about what he thought the impact of the Obama health reforms was likely to be. And at the end, I took that explanation of benefits out of my suit pocket and said, you know, I'm wondering if you could do me a favor. Could you explain this to me? Amount billed, zero. Amount insurance company paid, zero. Amount you owe, $154. How can I owe $154 if nothing was billed? And he looks at it and he looks at it and looks up at me and says, I could sit here all day and I couldn't explain that to you. I have no idea why they sent this to you. And I said, well, aren't you they? And he said, well, yeah. He said, I just can't decode it. I'm at a loss. And then he sort of, he took a breath, and then he thought of another way to explain it. So he said, well, you know, New York State regulations, which is where I live in New York State, New York State regulations, I think, require us to word it exactly that way. That's what it must be. And I said to one of his aides who was, you know, nervously sitting there taking notes while this interview was going on, I said, would you mind just, you know, sending me those regs when you have a chance? And he got even more nervous because he knew there were no such regs. And sure enough, he sent me a regulation from the State of New York Insurance Department, the only statement of which was that explanations of benefits are supposed to be sent in a clear manner so that the average layperson can understand them, which wasn't quite what had happened here. So here's the CEO of the largest health insurance company in the United States, unable to explain the most basic communication that his company provides to its customers.
Did you pay that $150?
No. I mean, I wouldn't even know how to pay it. Who would I write the check to? Amount billed was zero.
And did you get subsequent EOBs and bills saying, hey, you owe that $150?
No. It just sort of, it obviously was some kind of mistake.
Okay.
But these mistakes happen all the time.
And you spend so much time on the phone. And a theory many of us have is that the health insurance companies intentionally make some mistakes, thinking, you don't have the time. to make those phone calls, and probably you don't even have the time to examine the bills that carefully, and you'll just assume you don't understand it, so you'll pay what you're told.
Right. Well, now I'm going to say something that's going to get you and your listeners angry.
Okay, maybe. Try me.
And that is that the insurance companies are not really the bad actors in this movie. The insurance companies are in many ways like us. They pay healthcare bills. And the culprit here, and the reason that the Affordable Care Act doesn't work, is not going to work, is that nothing has been done to curb the marketplace of exorbitant bills and exorbitant profiteering on the part of hospitals, medical device makers, and obviously the drug companies. And the insurance companies are as much the victim of that as we are. Now, they're terribly managed. I mean, again, you know, the CEO of the largest company can't even explain, you know, what his bill means. You know, they're incompetently managed. They're not very nice people when you get them on the phone, but they're sort of stuck in the same ditch we're in, which is being forced, unlike the payers for healthcare in any other developed country on the planet, being forced to pay uncontrolled, exorbitant prices and high profits that are generated by nonprofit hospitals and by drug companies and medical device makers. So in that sense, I kind of feel sorry for them.
Okay, let's look at some more charges on your hospitalization bill, and let's specifically start with what you were charged for the surgery and the eight-day stay in the hospital. You said that was a total of $149,872.50. Do I have that right?
But who's counting? Yes.
But who's counting? So $20,992 of that was for use of the operating room during your six-and-a-half-hour operation. Does that seem like a reasonable charge for you? It's very, I assume it was a kind of high-tech surgery. We're talking open-heart surgery.
Yeah, but you know, let's just step back for a second. There are two ways to look at it. So the first way to look at it, which is certainly the way I was looking at it the morning after my surgery and the morning 8 days later when I walked out of that place a healthy person, is that those people saved my life. So in that sense, would I beg, borrow, and steal, or insist that my insurance company beg, borrow, and steal to pay for all that? Yes. Were the people there, you know, highly professional, highly skilled? Did they care a lot about me? Yes. So in that sense, it's reasonable. If it had been $249,000, I guess I would have thought it was reasonable. In the sense that if you step back the way I did as a reporter and look at the economics of healthcare in the United States, it's absurd. That nonprofit hospital makes a lot of profit. The executives are highly compensated. The people who sell all the equipment that is in that operating room have humongous profit margins. The drugs that I was given, the prescription drugs that I was given, have humongous profit margins. And we have done nothing in this country, unlike every other country in the free world, to control that, because we have lived with the illusion that healthcare can be a free market. One of the hospitals that I write about in the book, the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, had an operating profit the year that the patient I wrote about, who was stopped downstairs from getting his first cancer treatment because his check didn't clear, they had an operating profit margin of 24%. That's an incredible profit margin. And yet they're thought of as a non-profit, you know, charitable organization. They do great work. They save lives. But, you know, everybody involved, except actually most of the doctors and the nurses, is making a ton of money.
My understanding of that is that hospitals spend a lot of money on people who come into the emergency room and then maybe get admitted who don't have health insurance. So they're basically charity cases that the hospital takes on. And the money for that has to come from someplace. What's your understanding of that?
Well, two things. First of all, hospitals spend a lot of money on charity care for people who come into the emergency room, and then they spend still more money on lawyers and bill collectors hounding those people and suing those people into bankruptcy. 60% of the personal bankruptcies in the United States are the result of healthcare bills. And it's not like, you know, people wander into the emergency room because they want to get something for free. You know, nobody does that voluntarily. This is their health we're talking about. Second, The Affordable Care Act really changes that because a lot of those people are now insured. So one of the reasons the American Hospital Association, the hospital's lobby, supported Obamacare was because Obamacare created so many new paying customers for them who would now be able to pay so they wouldn't have to sue them to collect on their bills. They would now show up with insurance. So the hospitals are doing much better. The for-profit hospitals are reporting record profits as a result of Obamacare, and the nonprofit hospitals are typically, believe it or not, more profitable than the for-profit hospitals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Brill, and his new book is called America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Brill, author of the new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. And it's the story of all the deals that enabled the Affordable Health Care Act to be passed, and it's also an analysis of what works and what doesn't work with Obamacare. You write in your book that a lot of people blame doctors for the high cost of healthcare, but you don't think doctors are responsible for that. And so I want to talk about doctors' fees. Let's take a look first at your bill again for when you had the open heart surgery. Your surgeon's bill was $19,500, which it was a over 6 hour surgery and a difficult one, and your life was saved. So first I want to tip my hat to your surgeon and thank him for saving your life and for doing a good job. But does that seem like an especially high amount?
Well, let's remember this particular surgeon, they keep stats in New York on the success rate of these kinds of operations, and he's in the 99.9 tenths percentile. So he not only succeeded with me, but he's one of the best of the best. The second is, as I recall, his bill was $19,000, but the insurance company their discount reduced that bill to something like $6,000 or $7,000. So
what's the point of that? I never understand that. Why is the billing number so high if they know they're not?
So you'll feel good about your insurance. So you'll
Seriously,
feel great
is
about
that
your
why?
Insurance. Yeah.
Did it make you feel
you see,
great
the
about
bill
your
you say,
insurance?
well, look at it this way. So suppose you have a co-insurance of 20%. So you get a bill from a doctor, for surgery like this. Let's keep the math easy. So let's say the bill was for $20,000. And then let's say the insurance company's pre-negotiated discount for doctors in the surgery group where he practices brought that down to $10,000. Then, since you're only paying 20%, you pay $2,000. So you look at the bill and you say, oh, my God, I got $20,000 worth of surgery for $2,000. Thank God I have insurance. So that sounds like a pretty good deal. Now, in the case of this doctor, it is a good deal. But when your hospital, as I point out in the book, is billing you $77 for a box of gauze pads that you could buy at, Walgreens for $2.50, if that, and you're getting a $77 bill for it, and then you see that your insurance company got a 50% discount off of what's called the charge master price, the $77 price. Well, a 50% discount off of $77, if you're still paying $38.50 for a box of gauze pads, it's not such a great deal.
You saw a lot of different doctors in a lot of different specialties when you were in the hospital, and you think some of that might not have been necessary.
I don't know. I mean, well,
you don't know, right? Okay, you don't know, but you.
But that's actually the larger point, which is, we never know, and we rely on doctors to make those judgments. But to come back to your question about, you know, my surgeon, of all the ills in the healthcare industry, if you sort of stack them up, you know, that would be pretty far down my priority list. For example, you know, the fact that, you know, you can be a salesman selling CAT scan equipment that hospitals don't need in, you know, Southern Connecticut, and you can make, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 doing that each year, or that you can be a hospital administrator in Pittsburgh making $5 million a year. The fact that my surgeon might make, you know, $700,000 or $800,000 a year, which is, you know, the equivalent of a senior associate at a Wall Street law firm, that doesn't keep me up at night. That guy is saving two or three lives a day, and he might be making what a junior partner or senior associate doing debentures at a Wall Street law firm makes. That is not one of the, you know, the great scandals in our society.
Stephen Brill will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called America's Bitter Pill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Wix.com is used by 50 million people. Learn more at Wix.com. From Viking River Cruises, sailing through the heart of cities in Europe, Russia, and Asia. Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at vrc.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Coming up, the concessions pharmaceutical companies got from lawmakers in return for supporting the Affordable Care Act, and how Republicans tried to block the act by siding with liberals. We continue our conversation with Stephen Brill. And rock historian Ed Ward recaps the career of rhythm and blues singer Barbara Lynn, who had the hit You'll Lose a Good Thing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist Stephen Brill, author of the new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. It's a follow-up to his 2013 Time magazine cover story investigating inflated and incomprehensible hospital bills. While reporting on the rollout of the Affordable Health Care Act, he became a patient. He was diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm and required open heart surgery. He's recovered now. Let's get back to our discussion about the Affordable Health Care Act. The pharmaceutical lobby supported the Affordable Care Act. What did they get?
As well they should.
What did they get from it, and what did they insist on?
Again, what they got what everybody got. And the reason the Affordable Care Act passed was all the businesses that employ, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of lobbyists in Washington, the pharmaceutical companies, the medical device makers, the hospital industry, the people who, you know, who make CAT scans and MRIs, you name it, they all got a lot more new paying customers. Because if more people have health insurance, that means more people can pay into the system. So there are more people who will be, you know, who will get a prescription for Celebrex, and their insurance companies will pay Pfizer the same money that my insurance company paid. So, you know, that's a great deal. You know, basically what Obamacare did was a very good thing. It gave tens of millions more people in this country the opportunity to have health care. And it's, you know, it's a long-time national disgrace that we're the only developed country where tens of millions of our citizens can't get health care. So what Obamacare does is it gives tens of millions of people the opportunity to get insurance coverage. That's the good news. The bad news is that the way it does it is it provides them with subsidies that taxpayers pay so they can get that insurance, or in the case of people who are poor, a 100% subsidy by expanding the Medicaid program, so that the taxpayers are paying for tens of millions of new customers to pay the same exorbitant prices and fees that everybody else has been paying, and which makes healthcare in the United States roughly the equivalent of 16 to 18% of our gross domestic product, when all of our competitive countries, it's maybe 9 or 10%.
So you explain how the pharmaceutical industry benefits from the Affordable Care Act, because so many people, so many more people now have benefits and can afford to buy medication.
Right.
Because it's all or partially covered. The pharmaceutical industry also lobbied against items that they did not want in Obamacare. What were the things they did not want to see in Obamacare?
So there are two or three proposals when it comes to prescription drugs that the pharmaceutical industry has resisted. One of them is let's finance something called comparative effectiveness studies. We'll have, you know, a group of professional doctors, you know, with peer-reviewed studies, and they will look at drug A, which let's say is, you know, $100 a pill, versus drug B, which is $10 a pill, and they'll report objectively if drug B at $10 a pill is as effective as drug A at $100 a pill. The pharmaceutical industry fought that and got that defeated. A second piece was, let's let the biggest buyer of drugs in the world, Medicare, negotiate the price that it pays for those drugs. The pharmaceutical industry fought that, and as a result, the law continues to be that Medicare has to pay the pharmaceutical industry whatever they say their wholesale price is for drugs, plus an additional 6%. That's how it stayed. So the third piece of reform on the drug side was, let's let people buy drugs in Canada if they come from the, you know, the exact same supply pipeline, the same drug in the same packaging. Why can't they, you know, do mail order sales into Canada? And that would just kill the industry in the United States, because the dirty little secret is that the exact same prescription drug in the United States is typically 40 or 50% less in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Australia, in every other country in the world, because every other country in the world controls the price of monopoly drugs. And all drugs, if they have a patent, have been given a monopoly by the government. And usually when the government gives someone a monopoly, it regulates the price. Not so with prescription drugs in the United States.
Would the drug companies say, therefore, Americans are doing more to support the drug research than other countries are because we have there's a bigger profit margin here. We pay higher prices.
Well, that's one of their arguments, which is the very high profit margins the drugs earn in the United States is necessary for the research and development that creates products that save people not only in the United States but around the world. Now, the answer to that first is the math doesn't add up. If you look at the financial reports that these companies file with the SEC and with other regulatory bodies, their expenses on research and development in no way justify the profit margins that they're taking. That's the first point. But the second point is, I don't remember who signed the United States up to support research and development to help, you know, patients in Japan and Germany and France and England. Why don't, you know, we even out all the prices?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Brill, and his new book is called America's Bitter Pill, and it's about the behind-the-scenes negotiations that led to the Affordable Care Act, the deal-making behind the Affordable Care Act, and it's also about what that means in terms of the pricing for healthcare now. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Brill. His new book, America's Bitter Pill, is about all the backroom deals that led to Obamacare, how Obamacare was only passed after all these deals were made, both in Congress and with the medical industry, with the insurance industry, and so on. And nearly 2 years ago, he had an article in Time magazine that was actually the full edition that was about pricing. And it examined seven people's medical bills and tried to figure out why are the prices so high? Who is making the profits? In terms of the deal-making that enabled the passage of Obamacare, you write that Republicans who had always opposed the right of Americans to buy drugs through Canada and have that paid for by their health insurance companies, they actually launched a plan to try to block some of Obamacare, block all of it, by supporting the liberal position of allowing Americans to buy drugs from Canada and having that paid for by their healthcare company. And that the whole goal of supporting the liberals in that was to get the pharmaceutical industry to block Obamacare. So
exactly.
So that a way of defeating Obamacare was to support liberal Democrats in wanting Americans to buy cheaper drugs from Canada and have their health insurance company pay for that.
Well, that's right, because they knew it would be shot down. It was a completely cynical play. And let's step back and sort of look at the big picture. What I think most Americans don't understand about Obamacare is Obamacare is a Republican policy position. Obamacare is slightly more conservative than a plan that Richard Nixon proposed in the 70s to head off a Ted Kennedy plan that was much more liberal. Obamacare is more conservative than Romney Care. So imagine the Democrats' surprise when they sort of finally relent through Senator Baucus in the Senate and write a bill that basically, kind of throws in the towel on decades of Republican opposition to more liberal plans and throws in the towel and says, all right, we're going to go along with the Republican plan. We're going to do Romney Care for the country. And the Republicans still oppose it and oppose it virulently and oppose it by taking measures like the one you've described where they actually say, well, we'll write an amendment into the bill that if it passes, people will be allowed to buy drugs from Canada. And we know that if that amendment is sitting in the bill, the all-powerful pharmaceutical lobbyists will get enough Democrats and Republicans to oppose the bill that the whole thing will go down in flames. And let me just stress something here. The lobbyists, this is a nonpartisan sport. The lobbyists were just as influential on the Democrats when Obamacare was being written as they were on the Republicans. The most obvious example is there's nothing of any substance in this bill about medical tort reform. And any expert who ever has looked at this dispassionately will tell you that the lack of tort reform is what allows hospitals and doctors either the reason or the excuse, you can take your pick, either the reason or the excuse to overtest in the emergency room, to order many more lab tests than are necessary, to order MRIs or CAT scans whenever anybody comes in and says they have a headache. Tort reform is nowhere to be found in Obamacare.
You're very critical of the Obama administration in terms of the bureaucratic administration of Obamacare and all the problems that the administration had with the website when it was launched as an example of that. And you write that you knew something was wrong when you asked different people, well, who's in charge of administering Obamacare? And you got seven different answers. Seven different people were mentioned as the person who's administering it. So what did that tell you?
Well, I was going to do another big time story about the triumphant launch of Obamacare. So because I thought it would be people in government, the law's been passed. And then in October of 2013, it was going to launch. And I thought I'd write sort of the inside TikTok of how they pulled it off. And as I started my reporting during the summer, as you mentioned, I began with the innocent question of, okay, who's in charge of this thing? And I got, seven different answers. And I remember coming, back to New York that night from Washington after reading my notes and telling my wife, well, this story is not going to work because they're not going to launch. And I think, again, the reason I did this book is I think in every respect, this whole saga of Obamacare, the politics of it, the bitter, partisan politics of it, the lobbying, and in this case, the challenge of governance, all are emblematic of what's really eating away at our country. The incompetence in the White House, we can agree or disagree with the president on his policies, on his goals, on his aims, but there have never been a group of people who more incompetently launched something, and it's principally because the people in the administration who knew it was going wrong went to the president directly with memos and in person and to his chief of staff and said, we need to bring people in from the outside to launch this. And the president was protected mostly by Valerie Jarrett from doing anything. And I guess one of the really sadder aspects of this is that nobody who knew it was going wrong spoke out and still hasn't spoken out, even in the aftermath of the whole thing being a total bust and for at least a year discrediting the whole notion that government could actually run a program.
So you're saying Obama was protected by his own people from knowing what was going wrong?
He was protected, but you know what? At the end of the day, he's responsible. He kept getting reports. He kept getting all these green lights on his laptop of all, on a grid. Everything's going great. Everything's going great. Literally the night before the launch on October 1st, his chief of staff called a friend of his and said, we're going to knock your socks off tomorrow. Well, he was right about that. But the president, whatever we can say about him on policy and on giving speeches, as a manager, he failed. He did not know what was going on in the single most important initiative of his administration.
There are several challenges now to Obamacare. There's challenges in Congress. There's challenges in the courts. Of all the challenges to all or part of Obamacare, which do you think poses the biggest threat to the program now?
I don't think ultimately any of those challenges are threats in the sense that it will be repealed. I think the big challenge, and the one I really try to focus on in the book, is that there's going to come a point, it's going to be, in the next few years, where something is going to snap. We cannot pay for this. We cannot pay for this. It is great that more people are getting health care, but we cannot continue to be a country where health care prices are 40, 50, 60% higher than they are in every other country where the health care results are as good or better than ours. It's just, it's unsustainable. So the only ray of hope I have is that Obamacare will force changes in the cost structure just because there are going to be so many more people buying health care that we'll just have to change the cost structure. That was sort of the implicit expectation that Governor Romney had in Massachusetts, which is if we enact this plan and give more people health care, then when they have it, we'll see that we have to do something about the costs and we'll get the political will together to do that. The question is, does Washington today, tomorrow, next year, in 5 years, even in the face of, you know, daunting health care costs, will they ever be able to summon the political will to do something about it?
So we started our conversation by talking about your experiences as a patient and the bills that you got when you had open heart surgery. So now, being an expert on the history of Obamacare, on billing practices, and on being a patient, if you could make one change, what would it be?
Well, it'd be three.
Okay.
You take the people who provide the kind of care that I saw firsthand in my own situation, and you put them in charge. You let them expand. You let major hospital systems expand, and you let them provide their own insurance. I'd rather buy my insurance from New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York or Yale New Haven, because that's a brand I trust, and then you regulate them like crazy to make sure that they live up to their promises and you control their profits. And at the same time, you regulate the cost of drugs and you provide significant malpractice reform.
Well, Stephen Brill, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I was glad to do it.
Stephen Brill is the author of the new book, America's Bitter Pill. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward recaps the career of rhythm and blues singer Barbara Lynn, who had the hit You'll Lose a Good Thing. A recent album collects her Atlantic recordings. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Barbara Lynn wrote her own material, played stinging left-handed guitar, and recorded scores of wonderful records for a number of labels. With the re-release of some of her prime material, we have a look into a vital part of her career. This collection of her Atlantic recordings from 1967 to 72 offers our rock historian Ed Ward the opportunity to look back on her career.
By 1967, Barbara Lynn was a veteran. Originally from Beaumont, Texas, she'd broken into show business at the age of 20 with the chart-topping You'll Lose a Good Thing, produced by Houston's notorious Huey P. Moe, the Crazy Cajun. Over the next few years, she followed it up with three more hits, including a song by Otis Redding, You Left the Water Running. Mo was her manager as well as producer, and he wanted to see her on a national label. Atlantic was the natural choice since it had people like Wilson Pickett and Solomon Burke recording hits, and late in 1967 they signed her. Mo took her into the Grits and Gravy Studios in Clinton, Mississippi, and turned her loose.
I heard that you're gonna leave me, and there are rumors, baby, yeah, it's another girl, yeah.
Thanks I Get went to the top 40 on the soul charts, but Barbara was up against Aretha Franklin, whom Atlantic had also signed around the same time they got her. As they did with Aretha, Atlantic decided to record an album on Barbara right away, and the results were impressive. First, they remade her big hit with a horn section.
If you should
it was a lot more relaxed, or maybe just not as urgent as the original, but she also had a lot of good material from her arrangers, Cliff Thomas, Ed Thomas, and Bob McCree.
Five times a heartache and growing, love divided by two, equals the pain.
But when it came to singles, the songwriting was by Barbara herself, and the album was still selling well enough 3 years after it came out for Atlantic to pull another one from it.
Someday I'm gonna be happy. You just wait and see. Some people don't treat a dog, baby, like you do.
Until Then I'll Suffer once again peaked on the soul charts in the 30s, indicating that Barbara was still a regional performer, big in the South, not so big elsewhere. Atlantic tried to fix that by engaging the great Spooner Oldham as a producer. Among the tunes they did was one that was never issued by Barbara, but became a hit for the Box Tops later.
But I know I love you so much. My life depends on your touch, and my love is a river running so deep. Way down inside me, it's so deep. So big to hide, it can't be denied. and my love is a river running slowly.
The 25 tracks on this compilation of Barbara Lynn's Atlantic Sides show a woman at the peak of her powers as a songwriter and interpreter, but somehow Atlantic wasn't able to push her over the top. She toured some, then retired to raise her three kids. But once they were grown, she began recording and playing again in front of an entire generation who'd never heard of her. She's still doing it. I've seen her recently and recommend you do too. Her guitar playing is fine, although her voice is mellowed with age, and she's still got those wonderful songs.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Austin. The music he played is from the recently released album Barbara Lynn, The Complete Atlantic Recordings, on Real Gone Music. If you'd like to catch up on interviews and reviews you missed, or just listen to us on your own schedule, check out our podcast. It's free and it's easy to get on iTunes or your cell phone app. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
When new love comes around, and your old love has put you down, you better make sure he's nice and easy. You better make sure, girl, he's not a never teaser. 'Cause let me tell you, girl, I've been a hurt, and I know a guy. When he's a flirt, so you better make sure.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. On the web at PAMM.org. From the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. And from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and TV producer George Pelicanos. He worked on the HBO series The Wire and Tremé. He grew up in Washington, D.C. and had his own brushes with the law before he became a crime novelist. He has a new collection of short stories and a novella. Join us.